it all over the place. Do we have sketches of you? Forgot to remember. But as soon as you open the eyes to move, the real test of the benefit of the process is right at that moment. Not how long you're inside looking, or how long you're inside not analyzing. The real benefit from the period of closing the eyes begins from the time you start opening your eyes. The length of time you didn't associate or analyze is the time the body has stored a certain process of cellular compression. And so when you open the eyes, if you move right away, you discharge it, and you lost what you meant to be. But if you don't move right away, even though you might have wandered all over the place, even to the extent you might even forget you were totally oblivious where you are, for that brief moment, the adding up of the value of that begins when you open your eyes. If you move as soon as you open your eyes to get up to walk, you decompress the whole mechanism. If you don't move and you hold on to the effect, the length of time you hold on to the effect when you open the eyes to the length of time you take to get up to move, that period is the benefit of the process. And what will that period do comes the question. What is the benefit you get from the process of closing the eyes, wandering all over the place, you even forget where you'd be. The moment you open your eyes, pick it up. It's that period that when you open your eyes, the time you get up to move, you have to watch how long you take to adapt to the environment. And when you get up to walk and move, that period, from that calm state, is a cleansing process for your mechanism. Most people may close their eyes, try to be shallow, open it and get up and move. And then after a while they say, well, they're not getting any benefit. They may sit down and practice a special technique, and after a while they say, they are not getting any benefit because they get bored or they don't have enough time to do it. The real measurement of meditation is not how long you can sit down and be silent or how much you have special techniques to do. It is the period between closing the eyes, open the eyes, and from the time you open to the time you get up to move. That period is the most important period of the whole time, because that is the measurement of if your body is transforming and getting ready to cope with the environment. If it's getting ready to cope with the environment, the time you open your eyes, the time you get up, function is how calm, collected you are, that you can cope with any situation that comes up. That's the measuring stick. And of course, it is meditating. Because in a split second, you can have all the awareness you need to do. Brain can meditate. So it's not how long I sit down, I do in there. But though that is an asset in a way, but that's not going to give me the ability to work here. Because I have to live here. Living to live is different than living to die. When I get up to function, I have to have my peace of mind to live, to work. And it can be impractical. And if I get uptight, feel stressed out, and can't cope with the environment, then I'm not dedicated to the practice. And if I can cope with the environment, don't get stressed out. And therefore, that it's enough for a good second and benefit from the process I'm working with. And the evidence will be from the very statement, what Jesus said. When the eyes are single, the whole body is full of light. And the light is shining in the darkness. The atoms are already glowing in your cells, but the darkness comprehends it not. Black hole of space, inside your cellular mass. But let your light, let your intellect, atoms that are lit up, that you can see when you close your eyes, shine before men. That they may see the good works and glorify the Father which is in you. The evidence that you are getting results from your meditation is if you are coping with your everyday activity. Then people begin to wonder, are you the same person that you used to get uptight? Argue, clear up right away. What have you done? What have you got? Suddenly you seem to be calm, collected, coping. You're becoming a light to them, a light of inspiration, something that will help them to realize that there must be something you're benefiting from by closing your eyes that allows you to feel confident to get up to function and not be afraid with life. Others began to feel it, some people may go to the extent to see a glow emanating from your confidence. They might have known you before, how you behave, and all of a sudden they saw there's something about you that is radiating a sense of calmness, a sense of strength. Sense of competency to cope. You may not appear to be the wisest person, because meditation don't make you wise. It doesn't make you smart, intelligent, know a lot of information. But one thing that's very evident with meditation is you don't panic under all circumstances. When all your friends are panicking around you, you want the meditation, the very process is giving you a sense of timing to cope with the environment. The evidence of that timing is in the daily events. As you get up and function, in that confidence to cope, you will begin to see in every minute detail of time you are at the right place at the right time for the right experience. That's what I call divine will in biblical language. Imagine you being at the right place, the right time for the right experience, and the experience neither is good nor bad, but just the opportunity for you to generate self-confidence, to cope with it. That is the whole essence of it. But when you can close your eyes for a few moments, come back to this world and move and be in the right place at the right time for the experience. And the experience is neither good nor bad. It's just an opportunity to test your capacity to cope. Now, Jesus had that last night in the Garden of Gethsemane, many, many years ago, to look down into time and see what would happen. And when he finally saw his own crucifixion, after he went to pray with his disciples, you know, he told them, come pray a while with me, and then for an hour. And then he came back. What happened? He saw them sleeping. They couldn't stay awake in their consciousness for an hour. They drifted away to unconsciousness. Yet he himself, seeing in his own consciousness what would happen to his body, said, Father, remove this cup. Creative consciousness, don't let me face this type of cellular destruction. Yet the picture is coming from the unified field. It's not coming from the imagination. It's already there presented as an unfolding picture for the individuality of Jesus to see. The same way as you close your eyes, there are certain pictures presented for you to look at. Then here is where individuality and ego comes to focus. Father, remove this cup. But nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. Even though I've seen this and I know it's a terrible thing to go through, I need to put this whole thing together. I gotta live it. So if I came to live it, I came to experience it, I came to cope with it. If I came to cope with it, then this is the benefit of the process of going in, how to cope with it. So, not my will, but thy will be done. He sees the coming event, and he's realizing his purpose in it. He has to cope and not panic. That is the real test of living to live. She goes forth and greets his friend Judas, who kisses him, but he calls him friend, he doesn't call him enemy, even though he knows he's been betrayed. And he goes through the entire persecution to the crucifixion. The final test will be in a couple of days. History proved the test is valid. He survived the grave. Which tells us this. When you live to live, you will survive your decent burials. But if you live to die, you may not know what happened to you when you lose your body. But living to live is you never lose your consciousness. I can't vouch for others, I can only vouch for myself. I fell off a billion years ago and smashed up my body. And I was deployed there 3 times, even on the operating table. But at no point in time, all the internal experiences that I had, and from my years of meditation, I can say this much. We will survive a decent burial. There is nowhere to go in the atom. But you may lose your sense of focus in it. So, unconsciousness only occurs when you focus upon living to die. If you focus on living to live, as all the great teachers offer us, you never become unconscious. And then, the reward is that they will intercede. These same beings that we call saints and realize that if we ever in doubt of their power, of their existence, if ever we are in doubt that they didn't live, or they might have been a figment of our imagination, is it these moments of death experiences, they show their intervention, but they don't interfere. They can intervene, they can do a lot, but they don't impose it. We have to go through the process. And if you go through the process and not be afraid, their compassionate nature intervention can be transferred to us, such as in the case of Lazarus. I know in my own personal life, intervention, compassion from that level imposed itself back upon him. For whatever it's worth, you have the model of the eternal law of life locked up in the caterpillar going towards butterflyhood. And he doesn't have to practice no belief system. He arrives there naturally by living it up. We who are humans, endowed with individuality, have the same thing waiting for us. So, all we have to do is to look in. Don't be afraid. Thank you.
Let's break for a little while. We have some tea up in front. If you'd like to be on.
Put the Kelso along. That's like a, if you're shifting back earlier, it's like a late morning thing then? Or do you always, is that always late afternoon?
No, if you're shifting back.
It shifts. And the tomato juice and raisins, that shifts.
See, it's 3 days before the full moon you move forward.
Yeah.
The day of the full moon you can mix it all over.
Yeah.
And in the last 3 days you shift back. So that the last day of the full moon you'd be eating a breakfast for supper.
And then breakfast.
And then you start back the next day, automatic cleansing with the breakthrough. See, it's designed in such a way that everything is automatically working according to nature. You don't have to interfere with it. You have to recognize it. And therefore, it will do its own work. It would be kind of impractical to create a universe and turn us loose and leave us in it and it not have its own laws to maintain itself. So every scientist knows this in the end. We don't break laws of nature, we break ourselves against it. But all laws of nature continue to be there. So we only learn one lesson, the anguish of recognizing it.
That's more than one lesson, though.
Yeah.
Madonna, could you describe briefly what bhakti is, bhava, and the other word is PRD?
Prema? Well, those are different rates of love. Let me put it this way. God is love. Read it backwards. Love is God. There's a vast difference between the two. One is action of the actuality, and the other is a description of an actuality. So God is love. That's actual. That's permanent. Nice Sanskrit origin for permanent. Prema. Ain't going no place. You're stuck with it. And love is God. That's defining what you think you got to say to God, because you already put your position to be separate to define it. So that's bhava, behavior. Bhakti, you're going to generate what? Devotion to behave, please him. See? So in the end you learn that love is not God. Behavior is not God. And telling yourself you have to behave to satisfy yourself in order to have experience or intimacy is not God. But what you do discover after you've gone through all the behavioral games of bhakti, what's the other word now? Well, intensity of dedication. These are all conditioning descriptions of your own individuality to describe the reality and its unity. In the end, you discover that actualness is you. You are nothing. You don't become God. You don't become love. So we end up fooling ourselves by saying, I love you. And to say I love you and prepare yourself to say, I'm in love with you, automatically you set up what? To be out of love. Because by the mere token you say you love and you're in love, you set up the process to have the end result of falling out of love. How many of us have gone through that? I'm in love with such and such a person, oh boy. And then a few years pass by, I fall out of love with the person. What love do they have? See? But if they don't say in, they don't say out. But if they accept love blowing through them, and that they are the result of this process, then they don't fall in or fall out. This is what God is. Now in the Greek language, love has two words to describe it. Eros and agape. And if you want to put it in the vernacular, eros is erotic. That means you're busy arousing yourself to generate, to tell someone or the creative intelligence you love it. You can get worked up and fired up. And then it lets you down and you realize what it is. You're a gift. You're stuck with it. that's agape, you know, gasp. You're gasping now. So you see, the real love is what? All right? God breathed into man breath of life, and man became a living soul. But to breathe into an object is to blow into it. So you'd have to first contain the air to blow. And the mere gesture, the mere mechanical action is letting go, a gasp. So it sounds like you blow something out. And when it comes in, it's like this. That's a rush. It goes in like a big rush. So we are the recipient. We experience eros. God, the donor, demonstrates a gap or blowing it out. Between a he, a gape, and a rat, a pull in, we are in between the two movements of the sonics. When we realize that air is pushed into us after studying the structure of the mechanism, and that tells us the truth of how we put together, and those are the laws, and those laws free us from the illusion that we love God instead of God love us, that he gave his only begotten Son. He is already doing the whole thing. In fact, what love have we got to give him that is not his? So you're stuck with your own but wrong understanding. You can't give back what don't belong to you. You see? You can only experience and appreciate what is passing through you. So the donor of the frame and the love that goes through the frame is all God. That the he, the agape, or the gaping, or the gasping, or the pushing in into the frame. So, but because individuality is necessary as a form, an individuality must fluctuate. That's what we call relative now, right brain, left brain. We are caught in the three labels of God that the Eastern people refer to as God. Sat, meaning existence or body. Chit, meaning consciousness or mind. Anandam means bliss or spirit. But the play is between relativity, right brain, left brain. Conflict. They call it the shake and the shiver. So that's why the Eastern people drew these different geometries to represent the play of relativity between existence as body, consciousness as mind, and bliss as spirit. You're locked up in it as a body, mind, spirit process. But you have to have individuality in order to experience the play. Without individuality, there is no play. It's unified field. So the play is in the relative movement of right brain, left brain, of the individuality. So prema is permanent love. Bhakti is trying to describe if you're going to be in it and out of it, and how intense you can be in both.
Does somebody here have a illusion that CCL 3?
Yes.
We can move your car into an uncovered area.
Right, it is uncovered. Oh, it is.
So, bhakti is devotional attitude. And the intensity. So when Jesus came, they called him a bhakti yogi. one who united himself with the creative intelligence through devotional attitude of the heart. But you have to realize that that is because we are endowed with individuality. There is no way to start off experiencing prema or the actual love if you did not have individuality as a means to work with it. If God didn't create man and give him individuality, we wouldn't be sitting on here to talk about it. We'd all be in the superconductivity level of the unified field, and that is where we came out from, the unified field. But God desired to create, you see. We didn't desire to create. Now, who's got the biggest desire? Didn't he argue with himself or Mrs. God? Come let us, they say come let me make, you know. If it's come let me make, that's a different perspective. But come let us make, that's plural. The matrix that we see would have to match it. Come let us make man in our own image and likeness. Therefore, any projection of a desire must match the designer. The pattern has to match. Otherwise, it's not valid. It's false. It ain't gonna work. So, a matrix pattern is already existing for a projection of a Xerox copy. If you don't have something to refer to, you can't make a print or a copy from it. So, man is a Xerox copy of the pattern. Well, let's look at it more in depth than what we normally think it means. Come, let us make a manifestation. Desire is present in creative consciousness, which wants to make a manifestation of its own self. And in order to make a manifestation of its own self, it must already pre-exist with its own completeness. Therefore, image and likeness is a Xerox copy. We are a print-off of that matrix. Image, likeness. Now, putting that in the atomic structure, image is sonics. Likeness is optics. Manifestation is the result, a Xerox copy of creative intelligence. Male and female, that is relative play of individuality. Right brain, left brain. To put it into an actual working mechanics, we are not the result of two sperms, nor two ovums. Because we're not the result of image-image, or likeness-likeness. We are a result of image-likeness. Two distinct opposites. So we are a result of sperm ovum. The law then would have to validate them to make a form. Come, let us make man, make a manifestation in our own image likeness, not image image or likeness likeness. So when we see ourselves as a reflection of it, we are the Xerox copy of sperm, ovum, sonics, optics. Now, in the beginning was the word, not is the word, was its past tense. word is sonics. And the word was with God, meaning the creative consciousness is already in resident in his universe as the matrix locked up with his own creative processes as a blueprint. And the word was God, telling us that the container, the designer, and all the contents are one and the same. And the word was made flesh, that is tissue. And dwells in jackasses. And dwells in trees. And dwells in stones. And dwells in men. That doesn't say the word does not dwell in a jackass, or a tree, a stone. But in man, it's chosen already where it wants to be in residence. So the word is made flesh and dwells in man. Individuality, to speak back to its creative self, is the endowment or the gift of the creator to his creation by selecting the human form. Flesh, tissue. There's animal that's made of tissue too. But this particular tissue form, man, is the in-resident benefactor and benefitor, one who benefits from it. This particular quality is locked up in us because of individuality to relate back. So, from the individual level, we can now bargain. Here's the phenomenon. But we don't know that we can bargain with it. Until some realized person comes to tell us how to bargain with it. It's like having an endowment left to you by your parents, but you don't know you're a millionaire. You still go around telling yourself you're a pauper. You know what I mean? Until somebody comes along and tell you, hey man, you got lots of money left for you by your dad. How come you end up like this destitute? He says, well, nobody ever told me. But I always knew dad was somebody, someplace. Whenever I call there, I get no answer. That's the way most of us live in our self-imposed thinking. Until a realized individual shows us how to tap in, then we can benefit from the endowment. So what we are really learning about is that we are a Xerox copy of creative consciousness, and we are endowed with the individuality to generate control over our lives by not running from it, but by coping with it moment to moment. And so when you break through the relativity into the actualness, all the things that you hear about begins to manifest. But you have two things to contend with. The dramatic manifestation of God's laws in your life, or the synchronicity of your behavior with the laws of life. Centuries ago, the dramatic behavior would be accepted without challenge. That is, you're hungry and you wave your hand over an empty plate and there's a whole bowl of fruit. You're entitled to do it until the world has evolved and they'll challenge you to pay sales tax. Just as much you're entitled to raise the dead to relieve the anguish of a loved one until the IRS come and charge an income tax for you. So you can't perform that type of performance anymore because nobody wants to come back from the grave to pay the income tax. You see, after a while, a lot of these dramatic things of a God will what? Will lose their significance in the evolving behavior of man. Then how are we going to believe in God if we can fall back on those ways to fulfill our anguish or erase the anguish? We have to look to God for something much more dynamic. Without the dramatics, the dynamics that will allow us to live moment to moment would be learning to synchronize with the very laws of nature that surrounds us and be able to cope with life and not be destroyed by it. Therefore, we will not in the future be performing dramatic acts, but we will be performing more synchronous acts and getting a more rounded out reality of ourselves, a more wholesome acceptance of ourselves. That is what the realized man has to offer. That doesn't say he cannot wield the dramatics to satisfy a need. But he's not going around trying to clumsy on the head with dramatics. He's here to live, to raise us to a level of accepting ourselves. And when we begin to accept ourselves for what we actually are, the synchronous behavior becomes obvious. And that's what Paul did. So the gifts of the Spirit is not the fruit of the Spirit. The gift of the Spirit is the dramatics, performing the miracles. The fruit of the Spirit is understanding the synchronicity of living life. So he quit and went to be a tent maker, to earn his livelihood like any ordinary person and synchronize his environment and relate to the process of the now time, living and dying daily in the Lord, interrelating in the consciousness of now and expressing love at a more compassionate level than the mere fact of being carried away with the dramatics. That doesn't say he didn't have the exposure to the dramatics. And to be able to do the dramatics, but we can see where he became much more mature for modern man by writing and describing the synchronous way to live with God than the dramatic way to live with God. The early 12 disciples, they lived the dramatics, but they never made the fine distinction between the dramatics and the synchronous. Paul did that for us. And then we begin to realize that the more we live and understand our actualness, we raise our consciousness from living to die to living to live. And doing what?
Selfless service.
Selfless service, yeah. That's the definite.
Is that after the meditation in that awakening stage that you're talking about tonight, is that the 15 minutes that you're talking about for an hour or whatever it is?
Right.
Not the meditation itself, but that break in between.
Right.
That's the time.
Yeah. And that generates the selfless service attitude. You see, because all life is action. and yet all action is love. There's no way you can get around the actions of the universe and not realize it's the play of love. But it doesn't say in love or out of love. Life is action, and action is love. Love is service. No matter how we try to relate it, it will bring out service in some form. For reward or no reward. Now the highest service is selfless service, which is without reward. The least you have done unto one of these, you've done it unto me. That's the service that has no reward. It's selfless. And is giving. No matter how we try to serve, we end up doing what? Giving of ourselves more and more. Therefore, we don't know the full reservoir of love without a challenge that requires us to give. Like the Good Samaritan, we don't know example of selfless love. But he's giving from his bounty in order to help. And he wasn't taking sides with anyone's views of what the person he's helping. He just is serving by giving in a selfless way. Therefore, he leaves himself open for more to flow back to him. Since nature abhors a deficit or a vacuum, the more you give without looking for reward, what's going to happen? It'll come piling in back as bonuses. And this is exactly what the law is. We can't break the law, but we'll break ourselves against the law by fighting with it or rejecting it, only to end up having to live it. And so service is a way of sustaining its own self. But the moment you render selfless service or any action that contributes to the continuation of life, as Schweitzer would say, his entire career was dedicated to the continuation of life. So he left his homeland and went to the jungle to render service for the continuation of life. This service, again, comes back to sustain life. So all service is life. And all life is action. So you make a complete service. All life is action. All action is love. All love is service. All service is giving. And all giving is life. We ain't going anyplace but within the circle of this process. So all the wise men or realized men live this moment to moment and offer that as their model. See? So the selfless service is the true understanding in the end. What I'd say this though, agricultural men had one limitation in his evolution. The way he communicated his knowledge of his relationship to God left him with a sense of his language left him with a sense of guilt, which in a way weakened his evolution. Technological man, his relationship to God is guiltless, which will give him their strength to live life. So the language itself, the spoken word, in the beginning was the word again, it's the spoken word that will determine for man if he will be contributing to life or phasing out from life. You don't feel it's valid to come to live, to phase out of life without participating and contributing. It doesn't feel valid. Yet you feel threatened by feeling guilty. But if you don't allow language to build up a guilt in you, and you reevaluate what you're saying about the laws of nature and their actual mechanics, you will find that the language now, when you use it, would contribute to the continuation of life. So the real problem with man and his relationship with God is not a lack of love, it's a language relationship which either generates a sense of guilt or no sense of guilt. Now, a sense of guilt could be considered like a passenger in a car, someone who's carried around by a friend who's good enough to drive around carried around. But how long can you be a passenger in a car until you're gonna get what? Disgusted and you wanna get behind the wheel. And that is the other side of love now. The technical man who wants to assume responsibility of his own behavior. And that is what you call living to live. The passenger is living with the attitude of something for nothing. The driver is living with the attitude of something for something. But we alternate between passenger and driver. And that's to the glory of God. We, certain times we are the driver, and at certain times we are the passenger. So we learn the balance. And that's primarily where we are at our present evolution. The more we can accept it and not be afraid of it, the healthier we become. Send you the Holy Spirit, the Holy Comforter, who will remind you of all these things in my name. Meaning that the creative intelligence in the man Jesus, having brought the knowledge to an agricultural conscious type of people, and they weren't ready for it in its true scientific nature, which is the technical language. The whole spirit, the holistic thinking, which we are all getting involved with today, holistic thinking, holistic learning. But it's only reminding us of the basic laws that we've built around through the agricultural communication that generates the fear and the guilt. But the Christ man has gone back to the creative consciousness, but he hasn't left us. But through the last 1900 years, man has moved away from an agricultural understanding of his heritage towards a technical understanding of his heritage and is becoming more holistic. So the whole spirit of creative consciousness is comforting us more and relieving us from the anguish of feeling guilty and self-destructive and helpless. So when this comes into us, we get a better grasp of the truth, it frees the mind up from all its internal fluctuations of lack of understanding, and then the understanding that is valid starts to precipitate it. Then we begin to love more directly instead of being separated and a feeling of separateness or a feeling of unworthiness. But we weren't ready for it before. But as we become more and more conscious, the understanding begins to take over. Then the direct love becomes obvious. And the language itself is the indicator that the human being is benefiting from the inner knowledge and inner unity. Because it is the language itself that breaks us down. It's not what we put in the body that breaks us down. It's what we are saying to ourselves that is breaking us down. There are many ways to test that, with equipment and other ways that you can see what words have a draining or a deficit effect on your mechanism versus what words have a benefit of sustaining the healthiness in your mechanism. So the whole spirit comes in another way. It isn't coming as a person, like the man Jesus came to teach us. It's coming back in a language relationship to how to relate to the creative intelligence who has put us together. The whole spirit of it, the whole understanding, the whole integration of it. So the agricultural language is phasing down with its guilt complex, and the technical language is taking over and making us free from the guilt and reminding us of our true nature and of our structure, how we put together, and show us that there is no person sitting on a throne in some antiseptic corner of the universe punishing us, that reality is already within us as we look in and identify. Then there's no feeling of being left out or unimportant or guilt. What is more important is that you have the opportunity for the first time to correct your misapplied decisions about yourself, your incorrect evaluations of your understanding, and not to feel threatened by them anymore, because you're not here to please the other person. You're here to reassess yourself in reference to your creative nature. And you're given enough time to do it from now till midnight eternity. So what is more important for you is to make this assessment and experience it. So that's what you call, I'll send you the Holy Comforter, the Holy Spirit, to remind you of these things. And in the churches, they have this blessing that comes down. And we call that what you call a quick plug to your truth. It'll knock you down, shake and shiver you. It's a form of cleaning up your act. But it comes in many ways to get you to reevaluate yourself. So we see different individuals presenting it to us. The benefit is when we lock into it. The soul
enter the body.
At no point. Man does not have soul. Man is soul. But man will keep deluding himself with his agricultural language that he has a soul to come into his body. Who is the designer of this body? God? No. Who And who is the occupant of this body? Then how is soul going to come in? If God is everywhere. Agricultural language will make you feel guilty, feel displaced. Technological language, which gives you a holistic view, a true perspective, what you actually are, phases out a sense of guilt, a sense of incompetency, and give you the capacity to release God from within you. But we are conditioned, we are programmed from the agricultural heritage because we had to evolve through that process to our present state. For example, which comes first, chicken or egg? As far as the chicken is concerned, it knows it comes first. As far as the egg is concerned, it thinks it comes first. But no matter how much the egg thinks it comes first, it don't come first. The chicken's got to be there. So as far as we are, as adults, we didn't born adult. We born child. And we live child. That's why Paul said, when I'm a child, I think like a child. Now I'm a man, I think like a man, meaning that the early stages of our internal realization with our environment has a guilt process because that's where the child attitude of regulating a child in order for it to grow up, to mature, you have to discipline it. Now a child's entire function is photographic. It doesn't have a sense of reason or logic because it's immature. All its behavior is photographic. Do this. And they do it. Till they do something that you don't want them to do, and then you say, don't do it. They hear you say, don't do it. Do you think they have logic when they do the opposite to it? They will tell you, but don't do it. And they make the confusion of things to you, and every parent goes through that, trying to reorganize the child to what? Have logical relationship. For the first 18 years, it didn't have any logical relationship. It's all photographic. Then the next 12 years, it's trying to reorganize some logic. So society imposes upon the parent, from the child, from day 1 to day 18 years of age, a responsibility to the child. But the child is spending those 18 years in a photographic process. And from 18 to 30, those 12 years is trying to get an identity of its own to function in logic in order to assume responsibility. And the day it begins to assume responsibility, it quits hating its parents and begins to love them because they're stuck with the same thing they gotta do. They see exactly the same thing with their parents, they gotta do it now. So then they turn around inside of their head. Well, that's how nature teaches us to go through the child stage into the adult stage, to go through the agricultural language into the technological language. A language of belief to a language of understanding. But we can't really understand when we're born and know how to function. So when it comes to a spiritual evolution, from the time you're born to the time you're ready to assume responsibility, it's all belief. Great as Yogananda, great as Jesus was, you know, they still have to go through the process of growing up to assume the responsibility of life at a mature level in order to function and give the understanding that he had to teach or brought to. And years ago, when I was encountered Yogananda, I wrote to him and asked him, where can I buy 100 books on God? You know, that's and then he wrote me back a very simple letter, there at Danole. He's that type of fellow. What is all the knowledge and all the books in comparison to 15 minutes silence in the soul? And then end the letter, Yogananda. Now, to find 15 minutes silence in the soul, and then say, in your soul, and I began to search for 15 minutes silence in the soul, and it was 18 years after before I experienced it. So I realized I had to go through the time I knew him in my belief systems to work it out, all the agricultural language to come to the actual knowledge of it, what the technical language taught me about my body, the actual things about it. Then the realization opened up, the understanding opened up. But I could not have that before, because if the body is not ready for it. As Paul says, I was still thinking like a child. And now when I'm ready, I think like the man or the mature person, understanding emerged. But in the early stages, I would say, yeah, where can I find 100 books on God? Where can I go? Something quick, you know? Can I do something, shake my hand, and God will give me consciousness knowledge? We're all going to be like that, want something for nothing in the early stages. Then we find that's not where it's at. That doesn't say we're not entitled to have dramatics. But if dramatics was all there is from God, then we wouldn't mature. The real spiritual power is the understanding, the maturity. So we see that in life around us. When the child wonders why the parents constantly discipline them, and when they become a parent, what are they going to do to their children? End up disciplining them. And I love Mr. Sinatra. I'd rather do it my way. I don't care what it is, but I'd rather do it my way. You see, that's the beautiful part of God realization. No matter what road or technique you take or avenue to find it, do it your way. But don't back out. That's more important. Pick any route you want to go, finish it, and be done. Not to talk about it and never do it. So, respect for every person's road or method is valid because that's what they have to go.
One had a pregnancy that was very bad. I mean, supposedly it was a 12-year-old who was with incest or something like that. Would there be instances where you would feel that you could tell this soul of being there? Or I don't know what that gentleman was talking about, but I sort of had a feeling he was wondering what you felt about abortion whether there was any time when there was not, it wasn't really God, it was really like a little portion that would, you know, grow into God. Would you ever, do you feel that when there is a conception that must be full of?
The agricultural language will leave you in guilt that you have done something to destroy, that you didn't create. It is until we begin to understand and look at it under all the equipment, and then we will see why we aren't doing a single thing to God. But God is allowing us to learn through our mistakes, to look at ourselves. Come, let us make man in our own image and likeness, male and female created them. And God breathed breath of life into man. Now that's an after process, it's not a before process. The image or the structure has to be formed first, before the breath of life could ever go into it, to be individualistic. And man became living soul. But really, man became living soil. Because this body is a composite of 144 elements from which this whole entire universe is made up. The environment is made of 144 elements. And is localized in a model of called tissue or flesh. But it's not a living process with individuality of its own, capable of confronting its own integrity until breath of life is put into it. Connected by the umbilical cord to the matrix is a hydraulic function, not a respiratory function, because it is a known fact that the nostrils do not draw air while in the womb. You're drowned. You are fed this particular process of hydration and contraction and dilation via the umbilical cord. And the apparent feedback of sonics, which may appear to be a living of expression, is all transferred back from the mother to the child. It's not individuality as yet. When the cord is cut and the organism is put in a position to synchronize with the air, and if that synchronicity holds, we have an individual. If that synchronicity does not hold, what are we going to call it? We may have to back it up with the equipment to try and make it breed, because it's not holding, the synchronicity is not holding. If the equipment doesn't do the job, and no matter how much technical information we may seem to want to make this individual form now, that is severed from the parent, to stay synchronous to the air pressure, and it's not holding it. Where is soul going to be an asset now? Or where is soul a deficit? There is no soul to be an asset or a deficit, because the mechanism is not holding. So it goes back into the soil to be recycled, to come back again at another later date to have another chance to synchronize. So to say that soul enters the mechanism is not valid, because if soul enters the mechanism, then body has a soul. But body doesn't have a soul. Soul is a principle by which body, mind, and spirit operates. And within this process, the individuality is soul. Your individuality is soul. It's endowed with the capacity to recognize its identity from its origin. Therefore, through this endowment, the body may learn to discipline its behavior and gain the understanding in cooperation with the mind to stay focused and to benefit from the spirit that sustains it. It would be the ideal soul or the ideal individualistic expression of God, manifesting the non-decomposing process of the body and the ability to be visible or non-visible to the eye or mind and to satisfy the eternalness of the spirit. This principal soul, this principal individuality could pull it together. The same is true of the caterpillar. Its butterflyhood is not outside of it. Its butterflyhood is already part of it. It has to work through the process of going from butterfly to cocoon to release its butterflyness, which is its non-decomposing quality. We have to go through that same process through our individuality. So man is soul by the virtue of being individual within a creative unity. Like a wave is in the water, yet the wave in the water is made by air blowing upon it. Now if that air blowing upon it is cold enough to freeze that wave, what you gonna call it, iceberg? Right? So, but then there, did the water have anything new added to it? The wave was already in the water and now frozen to the extent it looks like an iceberg and it's distinct. And that's exactly what soul is. Soul is a principle of our individuality that is locked into the creative intelligence and manifest as we work through the process with the body, the mind, and the spirit. To him that overcometh, I will not send forth a second time. Not the body. It's the fact that the creative spirit has individualized itself at the input of the breath that makes the transformation. You are transformed at the input of breath. We can call that soul, but that is not soul. Soul is the individuality, the whole principle that holds us together and gives us a sense of separateness. Because the designer, the structure, and the occupant are the same. So we can't really say we are God. God has become us. So I can never say I'll be God. That would be an erroneous experience. If that's not possible. But I can vouch for God becoming me. From that standpoint, I have no fear. It's already working as a guaranteed process. I just have to accept it and work with it. But to say I will become God, or I'm on my way to be God, would eventually end up not working. But to accept that God became me and flows through me in this unified process and yet in this individualistic mechanism of talking to myself, this is valid. That satisfy your question? So don't live with the idea you're trying to save your soul. Live with the idea that soul nature will free you from incorrect decisions made by the mind, lived out by the body, and coping with the spirit. So spirit provides opportunity. Mind provides discernment. Body provides the vehicle. Individuality is a synchronous combination of the three. That is soul. You are living soul. You are living individuality. Operating for a synchronous confrontation with the divinity. So you are not separate from the divinity by being individualized. When Yukteswar told Yogananda, when Yogananda asked him, when will I find God? He didn't say, when will I find my soul? He said, when will I find God? And Yukteswar told him, no one will get bored with ever new joy, especially if it's unanticipatory. Unanticipatory joy, a joy that cannot be anticipated and is ever new, is the manifestation of God. And so when the being, with its individuality, which is endowed by the Creator, experiences ever new joy, moment to moment, it's living in the fullness of God.
This was the best one ever.